Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site. Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-hosts.
Oz.
Kale.
For breakfast, I had Polycast. And it was not very satisfying. Just kidding.
Oh, wow.
Just kidding.
Polycast, not part of this nutritious breakfast.
One of our guest co-hosts on this episode is Merg, and he has written an ode to Polycast, which he posted in response to the 48th episode, and he has agreed to read it for us to start the show and set the mood. So, Merg, why don't you go right ahead and do that?
Oh, we're going to jump right into this, okay?
Yeah.
Ah, great.
I'll try not to laugh.
I don't know which one would be worse, laughter in the background or just stone-cold silence to make it more awkward.
It's okay. Dan cuts us out anyway when other people talk.
I was just hoping Dan wasn't going to do it, so.
We have a standing rule about that.
We have the author himself here. Why would I take that away from him?
Yeah.
Because you're Dan and you love the attention.
Ode to Polycast. My iPod's a mix of many tunes, Linkin Park, Mozart, and some cartoons. On shuffle a random mix may play Kermit the Frog, Snoop Dogg, and Cirque du Soleil, or 99 Luftwaffe balloons. But never is my iPod so fine as when there's a new Polycast online. All the other bands must wait on each Polycast release date, in my queue they all fall far behind. I look cool running in my gym, short shorts on, earplugs plugged in, but little do the others know that I'm not rocking as I go, I'm listening to Polycast again. Dan Q may sometimes be whiny, occasionally off track or tiny, much like our own Napoleon on a moose and Canadian, always in search of something shiny. I must admit, Cardamandua's my fave. It's her laugh that really makes my day. Without it, the show seems so dry. It makes my spearman fortify. She always has good things to say. I can't understate this enough. Thank you, Mackie, from all of us. Her job is done to perfection. Keep Dan from singing, no exceptions, and give the show the Makalua touch. Seriously, thanks to everyone for everything you guys have done. It's enjoyed more than you know around the world, your crazy show. Keep them coming and having fun.
Aww.
Awesome.
Excellent. We'll tell people Imran wasn't here because he was offended that he was left out.
And I don't think you want to tell your husband about that spearman fortifying part.
Don't worry. He read that thread before I did. He's like, did ya hear your fan email? I was like, what are you talking about?
Again, person who just read his ode to Polycast is Merg. He also sounds very much like someone who's guested on the show before.
Could you give us a better hint, Dan?
He was on a Modcast episode recently.
Well, that doesn't help. I don't listen to them. Just kidding.
The last time I was on Polycast, there were no ladies on. It was the guys' only show.
Mm.
So I haven't talked to either one of the ladies before.
Special day for you.
Any guesses yet? All right. Hint number four. His first modification was Christian strip poker.
Oh, Kale.
Oh, great. That's what I'm remembered for. Wonderful.
Yes, that's right.
I almost thought that a couple times ago, but I thought I was just hearing things.
So Merg is a DL or something of Kale?
Well, actually, I created Merg a long time ago before Fall from Heaven was ever created, and it was just the user ID I used on Apolitan, and I used Kale on Civ Fanatics, and nobody knew either one, you know, never came up. Yeah, I don't think many people know.
Oh, news to me. Wow.
That may be a very good thing when I'm writing bad poetry and posting it on Apolitan.
Welcome to Polycast, episode 49. I am Oz. Joining me is Dan.
Hello.
Cartamandua.
Howdy.
Makalua.
Hello.
And Derek Kale Paxton.
Hello.
Who also goes by Merg. The initial run of Civ Rev is already sold out in the United States. Don't know how many units they made, how many pre-orders they had, but apparently they've run out. Take-Two CEO and President Ben Fetter said in a conference at E3 there a couple of days ago, saying that they're rushing to manufacture more.
I'm surprised at this.
Yeah, I was really wondering how the console gamers would take a turn-based strategy game too, so I was really glad to hear this news that it is selling greater than their expectations. That's good stuff.
Yeah, they probably didn't run as many as they might with a different kind of game because they figured, oh, it's strategy. They won't want that, but apparently they're like, gimme, gimme, gimme.
Today in news, we talked about colonization and the new screenshots that were released at E3 and an article about if colonization is offensive or not.
No. Oh, sorry.
Next topic. Inforum talk, why governors are so bad in Civilization 4, and no trophies for Civilization Revolution gamers on the PlayStation 3.
In the Senate, we talked about where to put your Forbidden Palace.
In the research lab, playing Civ on a hex instead of a square grid.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
Let's hit the colonization stuff. That's exciting. The news section.
All right. One of the few people to ever select news when given the choice.
But it's exciting news.
I've never played colonization. The first one. The second one, I've seen the screenshots. Very impressive as far as, the Civ engine. Which brings my hopes up for future releases for Civ. The naval warfare looks very good. The screenshot with the boats. It looks like they're working very hard on this, and hopefully there won't be too many patches after release.
I tend to go the other way. Keep patching. Give me as many patches as it needs to make the game better, to fix all the issues, which is something that Firaxis always does great. There's a lot of companies that just throw games out there and either put out one little dinky patch and leave lots of big issues, or don't patch at all. So I like the way Firaxis does it.
Yeah, we take him for granted, but on the other side of the coin, it's annoying when you have patch 17.2. You just want to play the game, you know?
Yeah.
As someone who has played 90 minutes of the original colonization, Ian, I am shocked that you have not played the original.
90 minutes?
Do you have a leg to stand on with that, Dan? Come on.
Well, let me ask, has anyone here played colonization before?
Tons. Tons of it.
Yep, I've played it.
Well, what do we know about it?
I thought the most interesting thing about the screenshots was how unlike Civ it looks. They really did a good job of going in and making it look like a completely different game. I don't think it has any of the feel of, this is Civilization 4, but it's a mod that has these couple changes in it. It really looks like its own game, which is impressive.
Yeah, it's amazing what just the water alone does to update the look of it.
Yes, it looks new enough to be considerably different from Civilization, but at the same time, it looks as if you are familiar with Civ, and specifically Civ 4, you will still feel comfortable.
I like the interface better, I think, than the Civ 1. The Civ interface looks broken in places. It doesn't look like it was really finished in places, like on the top. But this is very clear. The world map I like a lot better than the Civ 1.
Yeah, that round world map is kind of cool and gets you into the feeling of exploration during this age of colonization.
In a recent episode of Modcast, we learned that one of our own in the community and one of the regular Modcast co-hosts, Kenneth Ferland, Paler WRG, who's interning at Firaxis, is largely responsible for the interface.
He's the code monkey for the interface.
Because nobody likes to do interface, apparently. I don't know why.
Well, so far it's impressive.
We do learn some new information, not just from the screenshots, but also from several reviews themselves. I think the big thing that we have learned, Poulton has confirmed with Firaxis, that this game is to be released in September of this year.
Whoa.
Wow.
So at this point, everything's pretty well set. It's just a lot of polish. We've also learned that there is a hard and fast end to this game. 300 turns. If you get to the end of the game and you have not been successful, from what we understand, in throwing off your imperial shackles after 300 turns, you lose.
That's a short time span, in my opinion.
That's, yeah. It's like a game on quick.
Well, yeah, it seems hard for a typical Civ player to be able to play on that game pace.
Hopefully there's a mod that can lengthen that or something.
Multiplayer will be four-way.
That's four-way max, or is that... What's that mean, four-way?
That's max.
Yeah, it's going to depend on how many colonial powers they put in, and if they're just sticking with the original four, that would be the only four you could be.
Probably the largest preview so far in the set that we've seen, as of this recording, is by GameSpy's Dave Kosak. What I found a little bit odd, and I honestly think Dave is stretching a bit here in terms of a negative. GameSpy previews have a spiffy and iffy box. Iffy may feel like a one-trick pony compared to the breadth of Civilization IV. Well, seeing as how Civilization IV Colonization is going to focus on colonization of the New World... Oh, sorry, Ben, Fritz, I didn't mean to refer to it as the New World. I know you have an issue with that, amongst other things. Well, one-trick pony, I think we're stretching it, because I think, and he probably does too, I hope he realizes that. He had to put something in there, because we know it's not going to have the same breadth of Civilization IV as it's focusing on a very particular point in history. There'll be more depth that you'll be able to get into with regards to this specific portion of history, and I think that's an understandable trade-off.
Yep, I think its strength is its weakness. What Civilization IV does so well is it lets you play from the very beginning, domesticating animals, all the way up to the space race, and that's awesome in that game, but you certainly wouldn't expect that to be delivered in all games, and it's kind of nice to take one little chunk of that and really go into depth with it and do fun things in a lot more detail than Civilization IV would ever touch this time period in.
If colonization is successful, they can make just a space version, possibly a futuristic mod, just a future Civ.
We could send it to a place called Planet, and it could have various factions crash landing there. We wouldn't want to break any legal agreements with EA, but, you know, we call it Alpha Centauri instead of Tauri.
Proxima Centauri.
There you go.
Hey, it's a whole universe out there. We can pick any planet we want.
Epsilon Eridani.
Yep.
Mr. Fritz, a Variety video games reporter and reviews editor, quote, "Am I the only one who thinks it's morally disturbing to make a game that celebrates colonization? The idea that 2K and Firaxis and Sid Meier himself would make and release a game in the year 2008 that is not only about colonization but celebrates it by having the player control the people doing the colonizing is truly mind-boggling. A game about colonization that's entirely about controlling the settlers can either force the player to do horrific things or let him avoid doing it and whitewash some of the worst offense of human history. Either option is offensive." Unquote. Wow.
I guess somebody's not buying the game.
That sounds totally uneducated to me. The whole concept of being offended by a game. In this age of political correctness, I think people take it a little too far.
There are far worse things. I mean, I know the real colonization of the Americas involved a lot of genocide of native tribes that were already here with people coming in. And I know it was a horrific thing, but he's looking at it from the wrong angle. They're giving you a chance to do it the right way, to do it a better way, you know, not to move them off so much of their lands. But you could also make the argument about any game that involves any sort of violent or horrible act. Is it morally offensive to go play something? I think he brought up Resident Evil in there. How much off is that? You're first person in their face killing people. Or any of the multiplayer type of games like that, where it's first person shooter. How are those any less?
I'll play devil's advocate on this. In general, I agree with what you guys are saying, but I do think there is some room to talk about, you know, hey, is this, isn't it? What is the moral issues here now? Everything Firaxis has ever done, they've always handled very well, and I know that this game isn't built around glamorizing some of the horrible things that happen. In my mind, that's the difference between wrong and not wrong, is if this game was about glamorizing the genocide of the Indian people and the horrible treatment that they have, then yeah, absolutely right, it would be out of bounds. Not illegal. I don't think we should have laws against whatever the game is, but certainly in bad taste and would keep me from buying it. Not only this game, but anything from that company. But I don't think that's anywhere near where Firaxis was. But along with what happened there in the bad light, there's also a lot of good things that happened in the founding of America. You know, the creation of a democracy, the break from the monarchy, and the fight for independence, which is, of course, what the game is all about. So that's the focus of the game. That's what it's glamorizing. The fact that there were some bad things that happened there that are not being glamorized, I think makes it okay. So I think there is a line that could be crossed, and I invite the discussion on anything, but I don't think colonization crosses that line.
And even in the original game, they gave you the option to be friendly with them. You do not have to oppress them to get to your goals.
Exactly.
You know, sometimes you even run across islands that are totally uninhabited by Indian tribes, and you can set up your nation there. You don't bother them, and you still win the game, as it were. I mean, I've even had games where I trained my troops by defending the Indians from the Spanish. I guess it goes into there's many ways to play it. If you play it with that mindset, if you're trying to press it, well, that's, you have a problem, not the game.
If you're looking at the civilization from the beginning of time to the end of time, you know, there's a lot of hot button issues in that in between. Firaxis has always done a great job of handling them in a way that's reasonable. And a lot of people would say they're actually a little bit too reasonable. They'd like to see it get a little harder edge. I have complete faith in Firaxis.
Yeah, they're squeaky clean. I don't think anything bad's going to happen. I think he's just being very paranoid, the author.
Yeah. Besides, I think that, well, modern historians have this thing now of looking at things very objectively. Part of that objectiveness is saying that we're not going to hold the people of the past to the same standards that we today live. You just can't judge somebody in 1600 to live up to the same moral standards that we do today. They just weren't like that. And where colonization is a historical game, taking away all those options of slavery and conquering, I mean, that's just ridiculous. That's saying that the past never happened, or that we have to make those people act like they would act today. And I agree, Firaxis is squeaky clean. They won't do anything stupid.
Yeah, they've proven it over and over again in the past that when it comes to somewhat delicate issues like that, that they have a way of handling it and yet not having it impact the gameplay and make the gameplay less fun. They managed to find that balance.
Mr. Fritz here gave a glowing review to Grand Theft Auto 4 and had no particular issues with some of its moral implications and things that you are able to do in the game. As I said, thought it was quite wonderful, but has
what?
Picked up cause against colonization, yeah.
What planet is he living on?
Pot, kettle, black.
Oh my gosh.
That's amazing that he would flip-flop like that. I don't know what reasons he would have.
To be honest with you, even though the title is Civilization for Colonization, wow, that looks offensive. It's very bold. The article itself that he writes is more forgiving. And he makes a point of saying, you know what, I haven't played it, so I don't know. But I think he's just trying to raise the issue of, is there that line there that games could cross, and where should that line be? And I disagree with some of his points, but raising the question is certainly a good thing, and he's not like, we need to pull this off the shelves and they shouldn't produce it. He's never making any of those statements, so it's more reasonable than the title may imply.
I think what you're saying there, Derek, yeah, he has a good point in that he's raising the issue, but the way he has set it up, unfortunately, any good that he might have in there in terms of trying to bring this discussion to the forefront is being lost in how he's
presenting it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good point, Dan.
Yeah, because those of us that are already favorably biased toward Firaxis saw that title at the first and went, what? We started off on the wrong foot, as it were.
Well, are we all Ben Fritzed out here?
I think so.
Yeah.
Let's give the man a break.
I'm not sure I was ever Ben Fritzed in, but...
Got news? Email news@apolyton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, the cutest, or one of the other news editors.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums. Why governors are so bad. For those who are wondering, what? In CIF4, there are 6 governor options which make it easy for you to customize what you want from a city. You can emphasize food, production, commerce, science, great people, and stop growth. They can be mixed and matched. And the person who started this thread, I am Fishhead. Okay. Said that he's becoming frustrated with City AI's poor choice of tiles to work, and, quote, it occurred to me that part of the reason the governors are so bad is that the player isn't really able to give the computer all that much information about what it wants, unquote. And then, oh, further quote, it seems like it would be much better if you could tell the computer about the ratio of food to hammers to gold you want as input to the city, and then the human is tasked with managing what to build and what specialists to task, unquote. As has been pointed out in this thread, if you have a general tendency that you want to go with, whether if it's an emphasis on food, production, commerce, at particular times in the game, for short periods of time, it could be beneficial. However, as Trimyro perhaps best put it, governors should have some very predictable behavior to decrease micromanagement, but they can never be fully automated, unquote. There is still the need for analysis that, at least at this point, is what's more capable for humans, which is, oh, if you're emphasizing food production, for example, oh, okay, let's increase, let's get the population up, but, oh, jeepers, that's going to create some unhappy citizens.
Put your city into riots.
Exactly. Or if you actually want your city to grow, but you've told it to stop growth, like you want to stop the growth now, but in a few turns, oh, you're going to be able to, for example, build wineries so you can have wine, and that'll be a luxury resource, and people will be happier, so the growth won't be so much of a problem. To me, governors, they have their use, but they are simple as compared to what the human is able to process, or hopefully should be able to process once you get comfortable with the game. So it has its place, but it's a utility. It's not a replacement for you actually managing your cities yourself.
Well, I've actually playtested this in several different ways. First, I have, of course, done it with no governors whatsoever, and while it's more efficient that way, if I have, say, 10 cities, I can forget to move a few citizens around, and then I may be a turn behind in the tech that I needed the turn before, because I just wasn't paying attention. Now, I also fully automated my entire empire one game, including the build queue, and it's amazing what the governor actually puts different cities on research during certain turns, and then switches back to different things, and it's very capable, but it doesn't build its military very effectively. It starts you out good. It gives you a few units, some settlers, but then it goes complete commerce all the way. Now, of course, the middle ground is to where you can use your governors, but you really have to check every turn for your slavery whips, because it won't whip unless you put automate production, in which case the governor will whip. Tested that, but the thing is, you can still forget to move, say, a city from production to commerce. You can miss a tech by a turn, and then you can be screwed on a trade or something like that. So, yes, the governors aren't perfect, but it's better than doing it every tile, every turn, all the time. And I disagree pretty much with almost everything the OP said in this thread, because well, there's one thing you can do if you're emphasizing production, is there's a button there that you can totally kill the growth. In which case, even if it's a size 1 city that's next to, say, a plains forest with a hill, you can put it on 0 growth production, and it will build something very quickly, say, 15 or 20 turns for a size 1 city. Now, if you just put it on production, it won't go to that tile. It'll still stay on the food. Even though you click production, it's still going to grow. It's programmed. You have to override it. And in that case, yes, you have to micromanage the governor, but it's easier than doing every tile.
I suppose I can see its limited use, but I think I'm far too controlling in my playstyle to want to hand it over to a governor. It's kind of like, oh, I handed it over to the governor, and it's decided it's going to build that. Well, yeah, I agree with that, but it knew that that's what I wanted, so I might as well just done it myself. I mean, that's...
Yeah, I think it's a preference thing.
I've been really impressed with the governors, too, and especially in BTS and the work that Blake has done getting them to make decisions. So I think it's a great thing. I think it gives you some flexibility for letting the computer run your cities for you, but allowing you to kind of guide it. And Firaxis did a really good job of drawing that line between the two extremes. I know how the original poster wanted more options there, but at that point, why not just turn the governor off? If you really want to be able to micromanage what the governor's doing, then just micromanage the city itself and turn the governor off. I think there's some players, maybe like Mackie, that'll be graphing out what they want their cities to do. But for other people, you know, governors are great.
She storyboards her battles.
I do not. When you get to the point where you have a large empire and there's so many cities that you can barely keep track of, that's when you just let the governors do whatever. Just don't starve the people or something, you know. I have worse things to concentrate on, like, oh, hello, Stack of Death.
And being an American and seeing news articles about our real-life governors all the time, I have to say that Firaxis did a much better job of creating governors than we have here. So that's not too bad.
All praise mail can be sent to.
Praise mail. Do we get any of that? I don't think we've ever gotten hate mail either.
I wrote you a poem. What more do you guys want?
Write us another one. Just kidding.
Write a play.
Hmm.
next topic might be of interest to Derek more than anybody here, seeing as how he has CivRev, and he plays it on the PS3 in how that there will not be trophies in CivRev, because Sony just recently introduced that, and it was when CivRev was almost complete that it came out. So while you can get achievements on the Xbox 360, since Microsoft has had that from the beginning, there won't be trophies put into CivRev in a future patch, a future expansion, if they ever do one, what have you. And that's not going over well with some PS3 owners.
The only thing this topic did for me was make me feel bad for Elizabeth at 2K Games. Oh my gosh, people got such a fervor around the fact that they're not going to have a function that isn't in the game. It's not on the box. It was never advertised as being in the game. It's not in the game. You didn't buy it when you bought the game. So I don't understand how anybody could get upset about the company not putting it in the game. I think some of the people really thought that it was a really simple thing. You just go in and you add 10 lines of code and boom, there you got it. But it's a much bigger deal than that. It takes a lot of coding and planning beforehand. If you don't have it, and you didn't pay for it, and you didn't buy it, it wasn't there in the first place, was never supposed to be there, it would be like a nicety for me. Nothing more.
Well, wait a minute. Does the in-game music mean that you can put your own music in there, or does that mean the music that comes with the game or whatever? Like, does it support MP3 format, like you can put your own background music in the game playing? Is that what they're upset about, or is it more the trophy that they're mad about?
Yeah, it was brought up also about the in-game music support, and I think it's a required feature on all 360 titles. In-game music, I think that refers to, yeah, being able to have your own music in the game.
I can see why people would get upset over that.
Yeah.
But not the trophy. I don't see any. That's just aesthetic.
Yeah, I never really understood the fascination with trophies anyway. If you want to take a post-it note and put it on your monitor when you win, you know, hey, I won as the Egyptians, and you could stick it up on your monitor, and you could put it on your fridge if you want to make your mother proud, then more power to you. But I don't need my game to do that for me.
Post-it notes are so versatile today. First of all, you don't have to buy the 3M kind, which are considerably more expensive.
Oh my God.
You don't have to just get the standard square yellow sizes. They come in square yellow and little yellow and multiple colors. You can go nuts.
They even come in gold star colors. Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
As far as the Forbidden Palace goes, I don't like the fact that you have to prerequisite courthouses for the Forbidden Palace. Why would you build the courthouses if you could just build a Forbidden Palace and that'll help immediately? It helps to have the courthouses, but I really would like to build my Forbidden Palace as soon as it's available to me to build. That's one reason I don't build it, honestly, is I just forget to build it. When I want to build it, I can't, and then I forget to build it when I'm allowed to. But when I do build it, there's all sorts of different strategies for that. I like to space at least 2 cities away from my palace.
I was trying to remember if Forbidden Palace required a courthouse in Civ 3. As I recall, it didn't, and you could just dump it in the city when you had it up and ready to go.
Yeah, that's my point.
Yeah, I used it a lot more in Civ 3 because I think I would take over like an enemy capital or the center of where I pictured my future empire would be, this new branch that I'd just taken. And as soon as I took it, I would always pick one big city to be, okay, this is where I'm going to put the Forbidden Palace. And as soon as my build menu came up, I would click it and start going. And I never really thought about it, but I think you're absolutely right, Oz. I don't do it in Civ 4 anymore, and it's because I don't see it presented there as my first option, so I never think about it.
Forbidden Palace honestly really doesn't help as much as it did in Civ 3 either, because I remember in Civ 3, when I built this Forbidden Palace, I could see my gold just boom. It went up immediately. I don't even notice it now when I build it in Civ 4 because there's so many modifiers all over the place. It doesn't seem like it does much. Honestly, it doesn't. Once you get banks and all that stuff, the Forbidden Palace is a moot thing. Now, if you build it early enough, it'll help. But if you have banks and stuff, one bank in your capital will double any Forbidden Palace you can build in some outskirts city.
Certainly, Forbidden Palace, if you're able to place it sooner, I think you would notice in your gold income, whether that's you're not losing quite as much a turn anymore or you're actually earning more, but I still remember to build it. For those wondering about the Forbidden Palace, costs 200 hammers, you get +4 culture and +1 great spy, great people points, acquiring 4 courthouses and 8 cities minimum. With my larger empire, I try to build it sufficiently away from where my palace is. Ian, you mentioned a couple of cities over. I would also look at not only how far is it from the palace, but if I place it in that city, well, it might be the farthest city, for example, from the palace, but there isn't any other city terribly nearby because it will help reduce maintenance in nearby cities. So I'll look at both, okay, how far is it from the Forbidden Palace and what's also nearby? The sooner you're able to build it, the better off you'll be because you'll have those turns benefiting from the reduced maintenance as well as just for the city itself.
here's the thing. I know they wanted to bring over as much as they could from the earlier Civ titles, but with Civ 3 and 2 and all that, you could build like 30-something cities, and it wasn't a problem because of the way the engine and the way the code and all that was and the corruption. But now you don't have that many cities unless you're a complete warmonger domination player in Civ 4. So the Forbidden Palace really doesn't help unless you have like 20-something cities. And now vassalage has even killed that because you can't put national wonders on a continent you're just going to give to the AIs.
Even though we don't have infinite city sprawl anymore in Civ 4, which is wonderful, personally I think Forbidden Palace is still worth it. But you definitely have to take some time to decide where you're going to put that. We've talked before about dot mapping, for example, which I admit I'm an addict in doing. But if that's not possible, or you've got a lot of cities really clustered close together, I'm not as likely going to build the Forbidden Palace as quickly. I won't consider it as much of a priority because the payoff for the time it takes to build that isn't going to be as much as for, say, if your cities are farther away, whether it's on the same continent or otherwise.
It helps. It does help. You're right, Dan. It definitely helps if you remember to build it in the right spot.
Now, if you haven't built your Forbidden Palace yet, and you can build Versailles because you have that technology and no one else has built it, well, I'm going to be looking at Versailles first.
Absolutely, it's a lot better.
I'll semi-summarize, which is if we still haven't convinced you to bid the Forbidden Palace, build it because it says you can't. Right? Because it's the Forbidden? Say, oh, yes.
Was that really necessary? I mean, really. Just kidding.
It's Dan. Of course it was necessary.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but may be in the future.
Playing Civilization on a hex instead of a square grid. And what really comes to mind when I think about this is two things. One is the board game Battletech MechWarrior, when they had the board game and the hex grid, and it was useful in that case because of the pieces on the board and to see where everyone's pointing and stuff. And the other one I can think about is a game called the Europa Universalis. I'm not sure if that's a hex grid. I haven't played it in a long time, but I know it's not like a square grid like the Civilization series. The graphics are different in that game to where it works for that game. But Civ, I think, hex grid, it'll get so cluttered. Graphically, I think it'll be a disaster. Plus, units can already move diagonally, so I don't see a real purpose of that.
And I think when people see Hex, they automatically think of war games type of things where you're doing like World War II with tanks and things like that. Like, what is it? Panzer General, as opposed to something more Civ-like.
If for Civ 4, the ones we have now, if it was a Hex grid, you have to readjust all sorts of rules. And I think it's just, it's too much.
There's Age of Wonders, which is more fantasy-based and uses the hex grid system, and it does get a bit cluttered after a while, especially once you're further into a scenario and you've built roads to places and things like that. And it is really hard to know which way the unit's going.
That's my whole point, really. I mean, like with a board game, it works. You really need it in a board game because the way the pieces are and strategically which way your unit's pointing, and sometimes people even use rulers and they measure things out to the exact centimeter. It works for that type of situation. But when you have a computer that just figures everything out, all it does is confuse things even more.
The big reason that a lot of people give for wanting hexes over squares is that diagonal movement is so efficient. So if you were to move it just by moving straight, you know, it'd be two moves over to the left and then up. But that diagonal movement really is the two for one. And that's just a part of having a square grid. I don't think it's a big deal either way. I do like square grids because when you look at your map, you know, you can have passes between mountains are nice and straight. It just makes things much simpler than if on a hex grid, a mountain pass would actually be curved a little bit. So I think it's much simpler to use, but I do agree that it makes diagonal movement very effective. But it's effective for everybody, so it's equal, so it doesn't upset the game. It's not a problem for me.
And it's hard to find hex graph paper if you want to graph something out.
How often are you graphing things out in your Civ 4 games?
Well, I used to do more of the Civ 1 and 2, because now I have the function in the game where I can draw on the map. Yay.
Yeah, some people who are in favor of hexes say that, well, it is more realistic. The disadvantage of a hex map is that any given hex has an adjacent cell in only six directions instead of eight, as in a square grid map. People have already mentioned that hex grids are typically found on war games and board games. There are some exceptions as far as strategy games. The most prominent one I can think of is Settlers of Catan, which was recently to the Xbox 360 by Big Huge Games. But I think a hex grid works better more in a war game as a board game as Tactics, where you really want to get that sense of quote-unquote realism, but gameplay-wise, I think we're better off with the square grid that we already have.
I agree with Dan, pretty much.
I think it's also a little bit easier for people to make mods for it, for the graphics with the squares, and also when you're doing maps. If you're trying to convert a real-world map into a game map and you have it with hexes, I don't know if that would be easier or worse. I'm thinking it would be worse, even though it's less squares, sort of.
Well, I don't want to be the dead horse, but like the way the units face in Civ doesn't really matter. If a unit moves north, say, and then say a chariot runs up south of that unit, he doesn't get a bonus for attacking behind that unit. Now, if you do a hex grid system, like if he's pointing a direction, will it really matter which way the unit's pointing anyway if they don't get bonuses or minuses? So it'll really unnecessarily confuse things, unless you give them bonuses for which way they're facing, in which case it does get pretty interesting.
Hexes can also be a lot more complex when it comes to AI programming for movement and tracking, those kind of things. A square is pretty easy, you know, it just counts up how many to the left and to the right and then tries to figure out the best path to get from one place to the other, where hex is going to add a lot of complexity to that.
And maybe the core reason why we've never seen it in Civ is just because it makes the AI a nightmare to program.
I'm still a little put off because Mackie is graphing out her games. It just boggles my mind.
Do you like that? Do you like that? Do you like when I graph out my games?
Oh my gosh.
Is that good for you?
Oh my gosh.
What she said times a billion.
Oh,
this is a family-friendly show.
I will not make a joke about Spearmen. I will not make a joke about Spearmen.
Too late. Far, far too late.
In case you haven't visited a Polton recently, shame on you! In episode 50, we are going to have the one and the only Sid Meier to answer your questions on all things Civ. You can either leave us a voicemail and ask your question that way, or you can post your response in an official thread on either a Polton or a CFC. And not only that, this episode will be released on July 26th, which is a Polton's 10th birthday.
Dun, 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 dun. Oh, sorry.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at polycast@polton.net.
For more information on Polycast, our sibling show, Modcast,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.apolton.net. Which menu screen do you use in Civ 4? Vanilla, Warlords, or Beyond the Sword? I still use the Beyond the Sword one. I really don't sit and stare at the screen anymore. I will say that I don't like the change in the BTS logo that came with the 3.17 patch, but it's not enough for me to switch.
I use the original, the one where the world is circulating in the outer space. I think that's pretty neat.
I use the BTS one, but I'm never there for very long. You know, I'm just hit the main menu and then I'm on into my game. But I do agree with Oz that the coolest one of the three, and if I did care, it would be the original Civ 4 one's pretty neat.
I think that we should talk about if we're nerd, dork, or geek.
Oh, yeah. I did go and take your test, Dan, that you sent us the link to.
I took it as well.
How did you guys come out?
Well, I came out Joe normal. The closest I was like 40-something percent dork, and the rest were very small percentage, but it wasn't enough to be a full dork.
Believe it or not, and maybe this will have you question the validity of the results, but I came out as Joe normal as well.
Something's wrong with this test.
43% nerd, 35% geek, and 22% dork. It's set up so that as long as you're less than 50% of any one of those categories, then you won't be branded that particular one.
Oh, I came out 78% pure nerd, is what they called me.
Whoa!
With very low percentages of dork and geek.
Okay, now, as is defined by the quiz, and this was actually late last season discussion I believe Mathos was on, and it was talking about whether or not are you a nerd, a geek, or a dork, and what are the definitions. I support this quiz's definitions.
I do too.
A nerd is someone who is passionate about learning, being smart, academia. A geek is someone who is passionate about some particular area or subject, often an obscure or difficult one. And a dork is someone who has difficulty with common social expectations and interactions.
I ended up with 84% nerd, and I think I was up above 70-80% in the other two categories, too. And it labeled me as a cool, modern nerd. And it had a picture of a guy there who is neither cool nor modern, but definitely a nerd.
All right, so we've got two nerds and two Joe Normals. So, Maggie.
Oh, God, I'm going to have to be a tiebreaker. Ah!
I'll watch you end up being a geek.
It's going to be a total geek.
I think they need a question on that quiz for have you ever hosted a polycast, you know?
No.
That just immediately puts you at 100% nerd.
No, that dork.
Socially awkward?
Probably geek, actually.
Yes, I was going to say geek.
I'm a pure nerd.
Yeah, you and me. Oh.
Nerds are always just looking for new ways to do things, trying to learn about their world. Like, I don't see any reason why to use the toilet facing forward. You always want to face backwards, and then you have your little ceramic tank to rest your arms on, and it's nice and cool. You can put your laptop up there, and you can play some Civ while you're using the potty, and eat a bowl of cereal. It's nice. That's a very nerd way of doing things.
What the heck are you talking about?
That reveals far too much information. TMI.
I don't like to combine the eating in the bathroom.
I'm on a little unstable after this.
A little.
What, that's not the rest of you two? It's just me?
Yeah.
Okay. You just wait. Next time you're using the toilet, you'll be thinking, you know, I could stand to play a little Civ or eat a little bowl of cereal while all this is going on. Or maybe not.
Yeah, I would have never thought of that.
I'm not that desperate for one more turn. I have a Sims game, like the little one for the Wii, you know, it's like a little kid one.
Mm-hmm.
And I started speaking in the language. It's pretty bad.
Yeah, because I always say the same thing when they're going out the door. Like, it's like, zoot, zoot.
Garbuncle! That's my favorite. I don't know why I didn't rank higher in the geek category.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. Your number is going up as we speak.
Both of us.
Oh, sure, and I use the toilet backwards, and you guys, and I'm the weirdo.
Oh, come on. We're two girls doing a podcast about gaming. Come on.
Thank you for listening to Polycast 49. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have made recording it. I am joined by Dan.
Yeppers.
Cardamandua.
Hasta la vista.
Makalua.
Susu.
And Derek Kale Paxton.
Goodbye, and thanks for having me.
I am Oz, owner of several things, including the internet.
How much did you have to pay Al Gore for the net?
Saying farewell.
Susu.
Hey, who's in charge around here?
I am. Let's go on to the next thing.
I've declared myself in charge.
I thought this was the part where we make fun of the people who aren't here.
So, Merg, what do you think about that Kale guy? Whoa.
I don't think I'm old enough for this conversation.
That's true. Annalie just turned 25, so...
She's just a baby.
I know.
You're now getting closer to 30 than 20.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, that didn't help your quarter-life crisis, did it?
Don't remind her.
Hey, I'm 30. I'm hey,
hey, hey. I'm older than you, so saw. Wait, is that a good thing?
Yeah, I was just like, you're bragging about this?
So I don't know if you guys have kids or not, but if you do, they're already doomed into nerddom. They're going to be speaking Klingon before English or something like that.
Phyraxian.
Oh, okay, yes.
Phyraxlish.
Either that or Sim language. Gerbunkle.
Oh, the pre!
Recording. Record date?
July 19th, 2008.
Sound clips, copyright Civilization IV and the Warlords and Beyond the Sword expansion packs. Copyright 2008, a Polyton Civilization site at apolyton.net.